You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, proudly supported by Lloyds. Lloyds supports British cycling. A multi-year partnership deal with the British National Federation means that Lloyds sponsors Team GB when competing at World Championship level, as they did last week, and in the European Championships this week. Lloyds has also got the whole of British cycling covered, whether it's on the road, on the track, or off-road. And the cyclocross season starts very soon. The Lloyds National Trophy Series begins this weekend, in fact, with the opening round in Derby over October the 4th and 5th. You can go and watch some of the best cyclocross riders in the country racing at the Lloyds National Trophy Series, a long-running winter series of cyclocross events. There are rounds through October, November, December and January before the Lloyds National Championship Cyclocross in South Shields on January the 10th and 11th. If that's all a bit cold and wet and windy and chilly for you, what about indoor cycling at the track? The Lloyds National Track Series starts in Derby as well on October the 19th, and there are subsequent rounds in Newport, Manchester and Glasgow before the National Track Championships, sponsored by Lloyds, which will be held in February. Lloyds, there at every stage. Now though, it's on with this week's episode of the Cycling Podcast.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello, and joining you after a weekend when Tadej Pogacar vied for headlines with the European Ryder Cup team. And maybe the only man who could have beaten Pog in Kigali was beating a famous American at Bethpage Black. I'm talking about Mathieu van der Poel and Michael Phelps. More on that in a minute. My name is Daniel Freeber. I'm the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we'll revisit the main event of Sunday with someone who was there in the mix, close enough to smell Pog's cologne. And we'll also discuss other talking points from the last few days in professional cycling. That eyewitness, and indeed protagonist I mentioned, was one American who didn't get shellacked on a golf course at the weekend, although he may have taken a bit of a beating on the climb skirting Kigali Golf. We'll find out in a minute. It's Lucky Larry Warbass.
Hey guys,
the Motown Maestro. How are you, Larry? Did you understand any of that intro, Mathieu? So you know what the Ryder Cup
is? Yeah, I mean, I saw that. Yeah, was like playing with Phelps. Yeah,
yeah, and you know, your boys took a hell of a beating.
Did
you
know I? No, I didn't know that. I didn't know.
Okay. Did you know? Come on. Yes, you got shellacked, and yes, Mathieu van der Poel. He was there for Whoop, I think. He faced off against Michael Phelps in some sort of, I don't know, I think it was kind of target golf. And evidently he won. So victories all round for the Europeans. And also joining us, of course, is Cycling Podcast's answer to, I don't know, Rory McIlroy. I'm not saying he's foul-mouthed, because there was some foul-mouthed sort of outbursts from Rory McIlroy. I'm talking about his general prowess, Lionel Burney, of course.
Well, I'll take that as some sort of compliment from you, Daniel, given you're the Cycling Podcast resident golfer, aren't you? Justin Rose at golf as a junior. Is that right? Is that the story?
I don't know. Maybe you should do it. Maybe this should be the subject of a Lionel Burney deep dive.
You did play, very
good friends of the podcast.
You did play Justin Rose at golf when you were both teenagers.
Yes.
He went on to win a major championship and multiple Ryder Cups. You didn't. But I don't think you'd swap anything, would you? You wouldn't change a thing.
Oh no, he wishes he was sitting here today with you chaps. Anyway, boys, that was the golf. Larry, the climb of Kigali Golf, fond memories?
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, I was worried it was going to be a lot harder than it was in the race. So, you know, when we were riding, we were doing the pre-ride, we thought it was going to be like actually kind of crazy because it was pretty fast. Into like there was a descent into the climb and then pretty sharp kind of tight corner at the bottom, but in the end in the race it seemed to work out just fine.
We'll be talking of course a lot more about the World Championships later, but I think chaps, it's safe to say before we get to the news roundup, I think you'd agree that contrary to what some people said on social media, Mathieu van der Poel would not have beaten Tadej Pogacar on that course.
I think that's safe to say.
Agreed, Lionel.
Absolutely. But can Pog play golf? That's the other big question, isn't it?
I think I'm haunted. I'm traumatized by so many memories, so many Instagram stories of golf, of cyclists trying to play golf.
I've seen him golfing on Instagram, at least.
Yeah, I've seen a few of these. Damien Howson as well had a go in Kigali. I know that. It wasn't too agricultural. It wasn't great either, but wasn't too bad. Anyway, chats, news roundup, the newsette. Larry, you're exempt from this, although I'm going to ask you a little bit about some news you've got. Lionel, what's caught your eye over the last week?
Well, this is sport and politics again, following the pro-Palestinian protests that disrupted the Vuelta, which you were obviously an eyewitness to, Daniel. The organisers of the Giro dell'Emilia have excluded the Israel Premier Tech team from this Saturday's race, which is in Bologna. Partly, I think that's because there have been some pro-Palestinian protests across Italy lately, with one of the largest in Milan. And the race organiser of the Giro dell'Emilia, Adriano Amici, told Reuters, "It is with great regret that following recent events and given the characteristics of the final circuit, for the safety of all athletes, technical staff and spectators, I have had to forego the participation of the team this year." Now, Israel Premier Tech's due to race at the Coppa Bernocchi, Trevele, Varesine, Gran Piemonte. They're all in the run-up to Il Lombardia, the final monument of the season, which is next weekend. Meanwhile, Cycling News had an exclusive story, quite a seismic one really, featuring Rob Gitellis, the founder of Factor Bikes. That's Israel Premier Tech's bike sponsor and supplier. Gitellis is quoted in that piece saying, "I've already told the team, without a name change, without a flag change, we won't continue." Now, there's been, I gather, discussions within the team about changing the name. They dropped the word Israel from the jerseys for the latter half of the Vuelta. And I gather there's been discussions in the team, suggestions that perhaps they name the team after Sylvain Adams Cycling Academy. Sylvain Adams, of course, the team owner. The team has got until October the 15th to register with the UCI for 2026, and the nationality of the team can be based either on the nationality of the paying agent or the license holder or a product or service of a main sponsor. Gitellis further quoted in what was a quite extensive article explaining his reasoning. He said, "It's not a matter of right or wrong anymore. It's become too controversial around our brand, and my responsibility is to my employees and my shareholders to give them maximum space with which to grow this company and make it profitable. Adding additional level of conflict or complexity, we just can't accept that anymore. It's no longer a personal thing of if I support this or I support that. There's just a certain level of controversy that we can't have surrounding the brand." So it looks like there will need to be, for commercial reasons, a change of name. Now, it could be that the team is rebranded as Premier Tech or even Premier Tech Factor. The sticking point may well be whether the team's registered as Israeli or whether it's registered as Canadian, because Premier Tech is a Canadian company. But this is obviously a part of the fallout, one of the consequences of those protests that disrupted the Vuelta so significantly.
Lionel, my turn, I guess. My item is more of an update, a footnote to last week. It was our World's Preview episode last week, and my curiosity had been piqued by the presence on the start list for Sunday's road race of a certain Valerio Alessandri, who was supposed to be riding for a country called Nauru. We spoke about this last week. Larry, did you know anything about this?
Did not.
Well, Nauru is, I think we established it was the third smallest country in the world, a small island in the South Pacific, and of course, Valerio Alessandri is a very Italian-sounding name. It turned out, we believe, that this gentleman was born in Locarno in Switzerland, so Italian-speaking Switzerland. And I promised that I would investigate further. Well, word got around, some of our colleagues did investigate further, those who were on the ground in Kigali, and I asked one of them, a gentleman who works for RAI, Italian television, Ettore Giovanelli, if he could pass on the contact details of Valerio Alessandri, who he'd managed to interview in Kigali. So, yesterday, in fact, I managed to catch up with Valerio Alessandri.
Cercando anch'io un po' su internet, ho scoperto che il paese Nauru era l'ultima nazione al mondo a essersi affiliata all'UCI, quindi la 205esima nazione.
Ah.
E io, e quindi ho pensato, sarebbe bello chiedere la licenza all'isola Nauru.
So chaps, what did Valerio explain? Well, this whole plan to compete for Nauru came about in mid-August, early to mid-August. Valerio told me that he had, well, his second home was Africa. His parents in Switzerland, they owned a sort of travel agency. And consequently, you know, when he was growing up, he spent some time in Kenya. He spent some time in Madagascar. He considered Africa his second home. And well, he happened to find out some point a few months ago that Nauru was the latest affiliate, latest federation to join up to the UCI. What did he do when he found this out? Well, of course, he thought to himself, well, it'd be nice to compete for them in the World Championships in Africa, the first African World Championships. How did he go about doing it? Well, he made some inquiries. He looked on the UCI website. On the UCI website, the federation had an email address, a telephone number. He tried to contact them, didn't make much headway. He then tried on social media. And the best he could do was find something called the Nauru Cycling Club on Facebook. He sent off some messages to them. They, or someone in that organization, eventually replied to him and said, Valerio, old son, great idea. Let's make it happen. He then provided all of the necessary paperwork, booked his trip to Nauru, started training very hard. Now, I asked Valerio, what kind of level of cyclist is he? And he said, well, I'm 40 years old, but, and obviously he's not a professional cyclist. He works for the Swiss Tourist Board. And he said, well, I started riding harder, training harder. I took some KOMs on climbs around Egle. He lives near Egle, actually, near the UCI headquarters, coincidentally. And so he, you know, he was as well trained as he could be. He booked his trip. And, well, his contact at the Nauru Cycling Club assured him that he was in. He had a place. And we also saw that he had a place on the start list, at least according to Pro Cycling Stats and various other places, and in fact the UCI's own website. So off he went to Africa. However, when he got there, he was informed that there were problems with the registration and that he needed to follow up with the Nauru Federation. Of course, he tried before to contact the Nauru Federation, not got very far. Well, this time when he tried to contact them, they responded to the UCI that they didn't know who this guy was. They had nothing to do with him. And so his registration was withdrawn. So what does a man do who's gone to compete in the World Championships for Nauru and had his place taken away? Well, he decides to become the team manager for Sao Tome and Príncipe, who were also, which is a small island off the, what coast is it? It's the west coast of Africa. They had a wild card for the World Championships. Now, Valerio had been there on holiday three times and he'd met some cyclists there and he'd befriended these cyclists. So what a coincidence. The two cyclists that he'd befriended, well, they were sort of, they were eligible, equipped, I suppose, to ride the World Championships. The UCI, well, no, I should say, the Sao Tome and Principe Federation couldn't pay for them to go, didn't have the money. But the UCI have something called, I think it's called the Solidarity Fund, which allows them to pay for people, you know, in countries that aren't very well developed from a cycling point of view, to pay for them to go to World Championships. Well, Valerio applied on his two friends' behalf for solidarity funds, and the UCI obliged and paid for the tickets to these two gentlemen to go to the Worlds and compete in the Worlds. So Valerio spent the weekend as their sort of team manager, masseur, sort of odd job man, and he had himself a fantastic weekend. This was a story he told. Memorable weekend. I said, have you done this kind of thing before? And he said, well, no, but you know, it has been done before in other sports. We even had the situation a few years ago where there was a Dutchman competing for the Vatican City in the World Championships in Wollongong, and I think also in Glasgow. Because I did say to Valeria, well, if you weren't a citizen of Nauru, then how were you going to get a license? And he said, well, I don't know about the details, but they assured me that this could happen. It didn't happen. It's probably not going to happen in the future. However, he says that he would like to go to Nauru. He was interested, as I was, by this. Well, he was very curious about this tiny island, what he'd heard about their phosphate. They had a lot of phosphate mines, and the country did very well for a long time off the back of this. But the phosphate had all been sort of exploited, and since then, Nauru's kind of fallen on hard times, and it's the most obese country in the world. So this is a big problem in Nauru, and he thought that him competing in the world championships for Nauru would be a way to sort of send a message to the people of Nauru about the importance of being active and being healthy. So there you go, chaps. What a yarn. Lionel, I think on the 1101 cappuccino on Substack, we might publish the sort of transcript of my conversation with Valerio this week. But yeah.
With pleasure, Daniel. Yeah, I thought that was going to go in one of two ways. The real prosaic way was that he had arrived in Kigali and had been informed by the UCI that he hadn't been in the UCI's anti-doping registered testing pool for long enough, or some kind of, you know, bureaucracy like that. Or the kind of the Hollywood movie version is that the UCI president David Lapartient took exception to having his Strava KOMs beaten around Aigle and stepped in to bar poor Nauru from having a representative in the World Championships. But no, quite a story, Daniel.
Indeed. Lionel, last item of news this week, a bit of a sad sort of postscript to today's news roundup. The world of cycling lost some influential figures this week, didn't it? One was Cor Vos, a Dutch photographer who I certainly had dealings with over the years. I'm sure you did as well. One of the sort of legends, the kind of the monuments of cycling photography. This is it's a glamorous job, but it's also a very dangerous job. If you speak to any of the guys that follow races for years, and a lot of them have been around for years and decades, likes of Tim Davala and people like that, you know, they do talk as well about how dangerous it is on the back of a motorbike, and obviously how sort of tiring and how arduous it can be. But Cor Vos was someone whose photographs, well, they adorned some of the most famous pages in the history books of this sport for many decades, didn't they?
Yeah, and close colleague and contemporary of Graham Watson as well. And they work very closely together on the road. Many, many classics and grand tours. And if you were reading about cycling in any of the magazines through the 80s and 90s and into the 2000s, you will undoubtedly have seen a Cor Vos photo, because he was one of the people covering the whole circuit from the start of the spring classics through to the, you know, end of the road racing season.
Also, this week, Lionel, the world of cycling lost someone else who contributed greatly to the sort of telling, retelling, chronicling of this sport, and that was the Danish poet, writer, film director Jürgen Leth, who, of course, was probably most famous in cycling for being the director of probably the two most famous films ever made about cycling, A Sunday in Hell and Stars and Water Carriers. These weren't the only films, incidentally, Jürgen Leth made about professional cycling, but they were, as I say, two of the most memorable, influential, I would say. And he was a good friend and colleague of our good friend and colleague, Brian Nygaard. And we thought, didn't we, Lionel, that it would be opportune to give Brian the opportunity to remember his friend and colleague Jürgen Leth. So we're going to hear a short tribute from Brian here. A longer tribute, audio tribute, will also appear on the same Substack, the newsletter that I mentioned a minute ago, with the interview with Valerio Alessandri this week.
Yeah, and just before we hear from Brian, a few years ago during the lockdown Giro d'Italia that we created, Our Giro, Daniel, do you remember we made an episode, one of the early stages was called Stars and Water Carriers, and it featured an interview between Richard Moore, our very dear late friend Richard Moore, and Jorgen. So we will put a link to that in the 1101 Cappuccino as well, because it's a really lovely listen.
Jürgen Leth was first and foremost in his early years a poet. His debut was in 1962, And actually in 1967, he published a book called Sports Poems, which at the time was completely unheard of. His latest book of poetry was published this summer, so he was active right until the last months of his life. Now, cycling was a very big part of Jorgen's life. As a young student, when he was hitchhiking through Europe, he actually ended up in Milano and was able to catch a glimpse of Fausto Coppi training at the Vigorelli track. And Fausto Coppi was really Jorgen's all-time greatest cycling hero, amongst many, but no one stood above Fausto Coppi for Jorgen. He covered his first Tour de France in 1970, and he started commentating the Tour de France for the Danish broadcast in the late 1980s. And this was actually before there were any real sort of Danish superstars or any Danish results really to speak of. Luckily for me, he was also commentating a lot of other races because when I was a student, I didn't really care much for sport. I was into books, I was into reading, I was into movies. Actually by coincidence, I ended up watching what is now actually 30 years ago, the World Championships in 1995. I was visiting my parents and it was watching the live transmission from Colombia. I completely got sucked into via Jorgen's commentating this amazing race. Some of our older listeners might have seen it, and it was, for me at least, one of the most captivating races, and it was the first real cycling race that I'd actually seen. And because of Jorgen's sort of narrative around this race, I got completely hooked on professional cycling, actually to the point where it sort of took over my life, and most of my time besides studying philosophy went into cycling, and I saw every single race, and especially the races where Jorgen was a commentator. In Danish mainstream culture, Jorgen was probably one of the most well-known and loved personalities. He really was the voice of cycling in Denmark. And it's quite odd because Jorgen was really not mainstream in, you know, like I said, he was a poet, a filmmaker, a documentarist, an intellectual, a lover of fine dining, a lover of wine, architecture. But yet he was still able to, via his really unmistaken passion for all of these things, he became really someone that everyone came to love in his way to project this really genuine love for cycling and for everything around it, you know, the cultural aspects of France, the cultural aspects of everything that goes into a big bike race. That was really Jorgen's contribution to cycling, and I don't think cycling would have ever become so popular in Denmark as it is now if it wasn't for Jorgen and his then co-commentator Jørgen Mader. And as for me, if I'm allowed to end this way, I can definitely say if it hadn't been for Jorgen, I had never would have never found cycling, and I would have never had a career in cycling, and I would, and that means that the last 25 years of my life, my personal life and my professional life, would have been completely different. So I'm very thankful for having known Jørgen, and I'm very thankful for, obviously, for the life that cycling has given me and still gives me. And in memory of Jørgen Leth, a wonderful person, a unique personality in cycling, a unique person to all his friends and everyone who loves him, certainly someone that I will never forget.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast Team Car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by NordVPN, the fastest virtual private network in the world. No buffering or lagging while you're streaming, nothing that throttles your bandwidth, but It gives you protection from viruses, malicious malware, and phishing sites when you are online. The most important thing that NordVPN does is protect your private data when you are on the internet. Important details like your bank details, passwords, and online identity can all be protected. And it's really come into its own for me when traveling, working for the Cycling Podcast, and connecting to the internet with public Wi-Fi hotspots or Wi-Fi in the press room or in the hotel, or even tethering up my laptop to my mobile phone. NordVPN gives me a connection that I know will be secure. One NordVPN account can be used on up to 10 devices, which means that you can connect the whole household up to NordVPN and know that everyone's details are safe and secure. You can even protect your Wi-Fi router or your smart TV. There are other benefits as well, such as watching your favorite sporting events or TV shows or streaming services whenever you're traveling outside your own country. Now, you can get a fantastic discount off a NordVPN plan by going to nordvpn.com/TCP. That will give you 4 extra months for free when you sign up for a 2-year plan. There's no risk either with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. We'll put those details in the show notes, but go to nordvpn.com/TCP.
Well, chaps, Larry, we mentioned earlier that you were, of course, in the World Championships. You rode the road race at the weekend, and I called you a protagonist. No, of course, not just an eyewitness, a protagonist, not least because, Larry, you were very much in the thick of things, certainly at the bottom of Mount Kigali. So we're doing a big lead out there for, well, you'll tell us about the tactics in a minute. But really, we invited you here today, Larry, to tell us about your trip to Rwanda. Everything about it, everything that you saw, experienced, and then we'll get to the race itself. So let's start from the journey.
Yeah, so, I guess, you know, I was looking forward to going to Rwanda. You know, I think, you know, it was a long trip and, you know, I knew it was going to be an experience, not like your normal world championships, you know. So, I guess I flew there the Wednesday. The race was on Sunday. So that was like a lot of guys went there either like the Tuesday or the Wednesday. And so on my plane, there was a bunch of other cyclists. It seemed like everyone who was on the plane was going to the World Championships, you know? So, it was, got there and then, I got there like pretty late in the evening. And then the next day we went for our first ride and we did like some laps of the circuit, which we were like, you know, I mean, it looked hard on paper, but then once you did it in real life, it was even harder.
Larry, so, based on your Strava, it looked as though you were staying out of town.
No, we were staying like right in town, like pretty much in the center of the town. So we were actually in a really nice area with the national team and people were like, it's kind of like the Beverly Hills of Kigali. anyway, it was super nice, really nice hotel. And in the end, it was actually a really nice city. We did some loops of the small circuit. And yeah, already we were like, oh, wow, this is going to be way harder than we thought. So the Côte de Kimihurra or something, I don't know exactly what it was called, the cobbled climb on the circuit, it really was a lot like the Quermont. So a little bit steep at the bottom and then flatter at the top, but it went on for quite a while. And like the cobbles were legit, you know, they were like real Belgian cobbles. And then this Côte de Kigali Gulf, this little bit less than a K climb, but pretty steep. Also was like, that was going to hurt, you know? So there wasn't a whole lot of recovery on the circuit and we knew that was going to be tough. And then we went and did a loop, the big loop as well. So, and like this Mount Kigali, it's like 6K and the last kilometer is like, I don't know, 15%, you know, it was like a wall. And straight after that, you drop down into this Muir de Kigali, which is essentially like the Koppenberg, you know, like a really steep, also hard cobble climb. So once we saw the course, we were like, oh, wow, you know, this is actually even harder than we expected. I think in the end, in the past, like a lot of times with the World Championships, you do like a flat or whatever, you do a little bit less hard lead in and then a circuit just for the end. And the fact that we started already on the circuit made it like infinitely harder. So yeah, I guess the days before were all about just kind of like getting ready for the race. And, but it was kind of nice. We got to see a bit of the surrounding area. You know, some of the other guys did a longer ride, and everyone who did this longer ride, there aren't so many loops from Kigali. Cause there aren't like a ton of roads, but the roads are really nice. And the guys who did the bigger loop said it was like an amazing ride actually. So yeah, then we went to a coffee shop, and I have to say, like, they had some really nice coffee shops there. Like, this coffee shop was like really cool, like beautiful terrace, everything. They had really nice coffee. So that was cool. And yeah, it was just a nice city, you know, it was like a good ambiance, and you could tell that everyone was really proud to have us there and to like show us their country, you know, even from like the security people at the airport to, you know, the people along the side of the road. And even when we were just pre-riding the course, there were already a ton of people out like cheering us on. So that was nice. And then, yeah, when you'd go ride like the days before the race outside of the city a bit, all the roads were super good. And yeah, it was kind of cool. You know, the kids would like run next to you every town you passed through and everything. So yeah, it was pretty cool. And yeah, with the national team, we had a really good setup. So, you know, it was really like we had a chef, we had really everything. It was like being with a pro team, you know? So that was really cool. So we were pretty fortunate. And yeah, it was like the Belgians and Aussies were also at our hotel. So yeah, that was pretty much the days before the race was just training and resting, you know?
A lot of riders mentioned the air quality and...
Yeah. Okay. So I will say like the first day, so I had slept in an altitude tent for like a week before going.
Unbroken or did you actually for 24 hours a day for a week or?
No. Just at night. And occasionally in the afternoon, but,
you know, it's yawning like now. Yeah.
I'm
starting
still
to get
tired,
some altitude tent nostalgia. You want to go back there? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, it's not like you're going to get a huge bump from that, but I was like, maybe I could be slightly more adapted by doing that than just showing up 4 or 5 days before the race. So yeah, I mean, I think that was okay. I think I was probably fine with the altitude, but when we got there, it was like, you really felt the air. So it was like warm and super humid, but I will say there was quite a heavy amount of smog and most people did not feel very good. So all of us, and even so Quinn Simmons, the guy, you know, who we were working for, I mean, he's from altitude and he was at altitude for, you know, a long time preparing for this race. And he was like, I don't know what is wrong, but this, like, I do not feel normal, you know? And I think it had to do with the smog. The other thing that we were unsure about is we were all taking these anti-malaria pills. So, you know, we don't know if that like had an effect or not. You know, I know some riders didn't take them, but I know that, you know, a lot of riders did. So it's hard to say whether that also could have had some kind of effect on our performance, but yeah, I will say we didn't feel incredible the days before. So, you know, I'm sure it could have been a combination of a lot of things, altitude, air quality, humidity, heat, all of that. So yeah. But the thing was, is it's kind of the same for everyone. So that wasn't, you know, tried not to think about it too much. And I guess I was just thinking like, well, you know, this everyone's going to feel average in this race. So it'll just be kind of, you know, the guys who have a strong head that can, you know, have the advantage. So yeah, that was sort of like the days leading up to the race. And then, yeah, the race was like hard as we expected. And the break actually went pretty quick. So we were all actually a bit surprised. We thought it was going to be a longer battle.
Larry, what did you, well, maybe you're going to get to that in a second, but what was the plan? Because we talked about this last week in the podcast that certainly it seemed to me that we've got to the point now in the, whatever it is, the kind of arc of the Pogacar era, where a lot of teams were going into this World Championships believing that their only chance was, maybe the early break, that they had no chance of going sort of head to head with him. And that might sort of change it a different world championships from other world championships, maybe more interesting. But what was the US team's plan?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, we definitely considered that. We felt like it would be good to get an advantage before this Mont Kigali. But, you know, it had to be sort of the right situation. The problem was we only had 5 riders, you know. So it's not like we could just waste any guys. So we thought, okay, you know, our best shot was maybe like, if there was a good group, I was going to go. So, you know, we were like going to watch the bigger nations, and we thought like, okay, if a good big group went, then I would also go, before the climb, but we didn't want to go just in like a token early breakaway. And so, you know, it was like, okay, we'd stay at the front and see what happened. And sure enough, it was just, yeah, really small, break that went, without like the super important nations. So we thought, okay, you know, it's not the right move for me to follow. But then France started launching, and then we started to follow that, and that actually made it super hard. So they had Paul Sexas and Valentin Paris-Pont were like attacking after the break had already gone. And, you know, because they started to go, then Belgium and Slovenia started to follow. So then we also had to follow. And that was also my job. And so after following this attack from Paul Sexas one lap, it took like, everyone was on their absolute limits. And then they obviously went into the red a bit too much as well. And then they were all on their knees and then they stopped attacking. And it's funny because every time you come through the feed zone, a lot of teams had these like whiteboards, you know? And like, I mean, I didn't see it, but apparently the French one said like, I don't know, like attaque pas or something, you know?
You sure didn't say pourquoi pas?
Yeah. And then everyone was like, oh, like what a relief, you know, like they're going to stop. Anyway, then it was like, okay, our main plan was to go for Quinn, because just before in Montreal, he had showed that like, you know, he was in super good shape. You know, he was third there on a really hard, probably the hardest 1-day race that you do of the year, at least on circuits and stuff like that. So we were like, okay, you know, he's definitely in the shape to do something. And also with the worlds being at altitude, we were like, that would be to his advantage relative to everyone else. So, that was kind of our thinking. And so we had, 5 of us. It was Will Barda, Luke Lamperti, myself, Kevin Vermaak, and Quinn Simmons. And so we thought, okay, you know, positioning would be important on the circuit. So we thought it'd be good to put Will to ride so that we could stay at the front, you know, because
was like, it important, Larry? Was it really that important?
It was a little less important than we had thought before the race, but it was still important, you know, just because like, if you were too far back on some of the climbs, you know, you could really struggle, you know, to stay in the group, I guess, or you know, it was. So yeah, it was, we thought it was going to be critical, but it was slightly less than critical, but still important. And yeah, so we put Will to ride so that we could, you know, stay always in good position. And then, yeah, it was Luke Lamperti was doing the positioning on the early laps, for Quinn. And then once those guys were gone, it was going to be me to do the positioning. And then hopefully Kevin and Quinn, would be there in the final. The original goal was like, hopefully I wouldn't have to do any work until after the climb, so that I could also maybe make it over the climb. But, the race ended up being really hard and we lost our 2 other guys before we did the big lap. So, then I had to do the positioning into, the Mont Kigali. So I put the guys in right at the front, which was really good. In the end, I then was able to like set the tempo for the first like 2K to climb, which was also good because I was like, okay, maybe I can make it hard, but like keep it easy enough that like Quinn sort of gets an easier run into the final part. So yeah, that was actually ideal. But then in the end, once they accelerated, yeah, Quinn didn't really have the legs, and he was dropped from the group. So that was too bad, because we had kind of done everything perfectly up until then. And then, yeah, Kevin Vermaak made it over in A group. And then, yeah, he ended up being our only finisher on the day. So you know, it's too bad. Hindsight's 20/20. But I think we did the right thing. And, yeah, so essentially, after doing, like, my pull, I went over in a small group. And then when we came back onto the circuit, we had already lost a few minutes. And we did another lap, and then they pulled us from the race. So, but you know, I mean, when we came through and they pulled us from the race, we were still like 40 somethingth on the road. You know, it wasn't like we were like super crazy far down. So, there was already big destruction in the group. So then we just essentially pulled off the side of the road and sat in our team's tent and watched the rest of the race together. So, and from there, you know, it had already exploded once Pogacar went. So, but I mean, it was like, you could just see guys were just dying, you know, and as evidenced by the time gaps at the finish line, it was just an insane race.
Mm. We talked last week about, well, we talked on Sunday actually, about the first few hours of races now, how much harder, like what we hear is that they're so much harder than they were a few years ago. And it struck me thinking about this more, you know, the sort of the genius, I mean, it's not complicated, but the reason that Pogacar's long range attacks work is that he wreaks absolute destruction behind, and that, you know, the reason we don't see chases get organized behind is that everyone's already on their knees at that point because the first hours of the race have been so hard. I mean, and it makes it so simple for his team in a way to just, you know, to ride hard until as hard as they can till the point where he goes, and then you don't get this organization behind because people aren't lucid and they're not fresh enough to organize a chase as well as whatever kind of tactical machinations come in.
Yeah, 100%. You know, I think that's also something I've noticed this year more so than in the past, in that, like, if there is a group together, you know, like we've started to see a lot of times, like in breakaways, things like that, the first guy to attack ends up winning the race. And it's because, like, if there's a group together, there's too much tactics and everyone's trying to save some for themselves. They don't go 100% full in. And so they go slower than the person who's alone in the front because that person's going, you know, as hard as they can. And so, you know, I think that is maybe a small amount of what happens in these races behind is, like, once Pogacar gets away, guys are started to, like, watch each other and play games, and then they end up just losing more and more time. But for sure, that's the thing, what they realized. It's kind of funny because before it was like Visma's tactic against Pogacar was like, let's just make the race hard and do as many KJs and then we'll crack him, you know? But now it became even more Pogacar's game, in the sense that, like, the more fatigued everyone else is, the better he is. So, you know, it's like, I guess that's the one thing. I think when you see this on TV, it looks absolutely ridiculous that, like, he's so far ahead of everyone else. But I think these small percentages in different differences in form are just absolutely magnified when, you know, you have all this fatigue in the legs. So, yeah, I mean, we definitely have seen, you know, the teams were riding quite hard. The whole start of the race, and, you know, the breakaway was given, like, I don't know, 2 minutes, max 3 minutes at one point, maybe. Whereas, like, in the past in the worlds, like, the breakaway would always get like 12 minutes or something, you know, it'd go like crazy far out. It'd be, you know, not really many important riders or nations. And yeah, it's just all changed now. So, it was a hard day and the pace was on the entire time. And a lot of guys I was talking to were like, what the heck is going on? You know, I mean, like, just on the opening circuits, it was just like guys were already suffering.
And there's also the disparity between the sizes of the teams. I mean, Slovenia had more riders than anyone else, 9. Okay, the bottom sort of third of that roster, maybe not the strongest riders, but still they have people to do work in those early laps and to be of some use. So really the onus to tactically shape the race fell on probably half a dozen teams. I think there were 7 other teams that had 8 riders. The US team with 5 is kind of a medium-sized team, more resources than some other nations, but those resources don't go very far on a race of over 260K, do they? You have to be really frugal about who does what and when. Otherwise, you could be in a situation with 50, 60K to go and you've got nobody capable of playing a part in that final third of the race.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, so, you know, I think we did have like 8 spots if we were to take advantage of them. But unfortunately, a lot of the potential leaders didn't want to come just because of the journey and a long season and everything. So, you know, I think it could have been a very different story for us if we had, you know, Brandon McNulty, maybe Matteo Jorgensen and Nielsen Paulus there with us, you know, because then we would have probably had guys to animate this final. But yeah, you know, I think Pogačar also knew that he didn't have the strongest team there. So he used all his teammates to the max of their capabilities up until this long climb. And then it was just up to him. So.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is also sponsored by Calm, which is an app that can help you to improve your sleep and also help to manage any anxiety or stress you might be feeling. Now, it's a funny time of year this for me because summer is in the rearview mirror and we're moving into autumn and then winter. And funnily enough, when we get to the winter months, I'm absolutely fine. It's this transitional phase that I seem to struggle with every year as the days get shorter and the nights get longer and there's a few less sunny, bright, warm days and everything just feels like it's shutting down for the winter. And in recent days, I've reached for the Calm app just to help prevent any negative feelings from spiraling out of control and to achieve a sense of stillness, especially before bedtime. With the Calm app, there are guided meditations, there are sleep stories, sleep meditations and calming music to help you drift off to sleep quickly and naturally. There's grounding exercises to help you reset and relax when you're feeling just a bit too overwhelmed by everything that's gone on through the day. And there's expert-led talks as well, which might help you to handle any difficulties you're going through. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, and it can give you the power to calm your mind and change your life. And I'm pretty confident that if you download the app and see what it has to offer, you will find something that will help you to bring a sense of calmness, regulate your breathing, and generally help you feel better, especially, as I find, at the end of the day. Calm has an exclusive offer just for listeners of the Cycling Podcast. You can get 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/cycle. Go to calm.com/cycle, that's calm.com/cycle, for 40% off and unlimited access to Calm's entire library. calm.com/cycle. And do tell Calm you heard about them from me.
Well, Larry, that was your race. We might return to your race, talk a bit more about your race in a minute. But obviously one of the main talking points after Sunday, particularly something that occupied Lionel and I in our Arrive episode, Lionel and me, I should say, was Remco Evenepoel's race. And obviously, as always with Remco, a lot of drama, a lot of sort of narrative around his race. I saw a column from one of our colleagues, Tate Zonneveld, who's always quite controversial in what he writes, the next day, which said that Remco, I think he said that Remco had behaved like a toddler, referring to his sort of fit of pique, and which we thought was fairly sort of justified. But there was some interesting, just from a technical point of view, it was interesting, particularly interesting, that he decided to stop at the side of the road rather than put his hand up, wait for his team car to come, and then change his bike. So that was interesting. The second thing was interesting, and I wanted to ask you just to state or explain to us very, very clearly and briefly, Larry, barrage. What is a barrage? When should a barrage happen? And when shouldn't a barrage happen? Because it didn't happen. And he was allowed to get back in the cars. And there was some debate about whether this was right or not.
So, yeah, a barrage is when, for example, there are dropped riders. And so say you hit a climb, you're a 150-man bunch. And then a group of 50 gets dropped. They will keep the cars behind that group of 50 until the gap is big enough that, you know, the cars can pass them without helping the riders in between. Because the thing is, for example, if these 50 riders get dropped and the caravan is like 30 cars long, that can be like a kilometer long. So they can still get the draft from the cars if the cars don't move. But so what they'll do is normally they'll keep the cars behind these drop groups so that the riders don't get an advantage from the cars. So, yeah, I guess it usually happens if, like, bigger groups are dropped. In hard parts of the race, it happens. I guess usually this is where it gets difficult, is when you have a mechanical, usually they'll let you use the cars to come back, you know, if you crash or have a mechanical.
Haven't the rules on this changed in the last couple of years, or the interpretation of the rules?
Regardless of what the rules say, I would say most of it's an unwritten rule, you know, that like if you've had a mechanical or a crash, you know, essentially if you are dropped out of something other than your physical level or whatever, you know, if there's some outside factors, usually they'll let you draft the cars to come back. What's the problem is when you're in a hard race and you get dropped because you have a mechanical, like you have to stop or whatever, get a bike change, wheel change, whatever. But then at the same time, there are people getting dropped because they just can't hold the wheel in the group. Then it's hard to decipher who do you let stay on the cars and who's just getting dropped. So, you know, this happens a lot, actually, in the sense of like, yeah, maybe a strong rider has a mechanical and a hard moment. And then that's when you even more need to use the car, you know. But then how do you decipher, how do you know who exactly, you know, got dropped because their legs weren't good enough or they got dropped because of a mechanical? So
yeah, and also what is the definition of a mechanical? It almost feels as though there needs to be a distinction made between a mechanical, a preference as far as the way your bike is working is concerned, right, and one which stops you advancing. In this case, one could have argued that there was one change from his wheel.
Like, yeah. The first one, I don't know when he changed, but all I know is he thought he had a flat or a slow leak, but that was already on this Mont Kigali. And then he didn't change till he got back to the circuit.
No.
And then the second one was because he didn't like the angle of
the saddle. Exactly. He didn't like it. I mean, I used the words preference. I mean, this is a good example of, I think it's a moot point whether that should constitute a mechanical and whether one should benefit from coming back through the cars or not.
I mean, if you had to do a bike change, I think probably. But the thing is, if it's really like this, the measurements don't feel right on this bike, I mean, that's your issue. You know what I mean? Like you probably should have checked it before the race if you know, is that big. You know, I mean, usually what we'll do is like earlier in the season or something, say I go to Giro dell'Emilia on Friday, or sorry, tomorrow, but the race is Saturday. Anyway, maybe tomorrow before the race, I take out my spare bike just to make sure that it feels good, you know? So that's like a pretty common thing to do. But usually once you've already done that once or twice or whatever, you're like, okay, my bikes are good, you know? What I had heard was that the mechanics triple checked the measurements after the race and they were exactly right. But, you know, the problem is sometimes, you know, for example, maybe a saddle can be a bit more worn in than another. So it feels different, and maybe it can even measure different in the end. But I mean, those are very minute details, but that can make a bike feel different. Also, the race had been so hard, maybe, you know, your muscles tighten up. I don't know. So then maybe just switch the bike. It didn't feel the same. And he was like, I got to change it. I mean, it's hard to say because like I wasn't in that situation, but I would say if I changed bikes and it didn't feel ideal, I'd be like, this sucks. You know, like this doesn't feel right, but whatever. I'm just going to like keep going, you know? But to each their own. So then that I didn't see because I will say, when I was coming on the first small circuit after the big loop, there was one part of like the course where, like, you know, two directions, like you could see the riders come the other way. And I was like, oh wow, like Remco's like really dropped, you know, like, but I didn't realize that was because he had done this change just before. And there, for sure, there were no cars. Like, I didn't see like any cars really. So he was like on his own. So he definitely came back there without the help of cars. And maybe the second time the cars had finally come back. And then, yeah, it's a tricky subject. You know, I don't know what the right answer is. I think in a lot of situations, you know, I think it's fair to let guys use the cars if, you know, they had a mechanical. But if you abuse it, then maybe not.
Yeah. And yeah. And then, you know, there's using the cars, then you get into discussions about what is a reasonable amount of using the cars.
Yeah.
And just on the first point, Larry, about the wisdom of stopping rather than carrying on.
That's a bad idea.
Yeah.
Unless your car is right behind you, like, you should always keep going. So yeah, you know, off air, I was talking about this Baltimore race, and I had gotten a flat in this race at one point, but the problem is our car wasn't behind us. And we have these liners in our tires. So like, they're like a foam liner that you can keep riding on a flat tire. It's for safety, so the tire doesn't come off. But anyway, in this situation, our car wasn't behind us. So I did like almost a half a lap with a pretty much flat tire until the point I was almost crashing. Then I was like, okay, now it's unavoidable. You know, like, now I have to stop. But, you know, usually you would ride until you're in a good situation to be able to change, you know? So I don't know, for example, maybe you'd wait until, yeah, the car gets up to just behind you, and then you're like, okay, now I change, you know? Whereas like, you would definitely never stop, just straight up stop, unless like you're on the rim or something, you know? Unless it's absolutely impossible to keep going, you'd always ride until the car is right behind you.
Mm. Final point on the worlds, Larry, and we were talking earlier about domestiques and this team sizes. Another thing I said on Sunday, just like you to sort of validate this or debunk this, I suggested that the feeding would have been important as well, particularly at the weekend, and that was going to be a key role of domestiques. And I think I saw an interview with Ciccone, actually the Italian team, who talked about the importance of ice and water and teammates bringing ice and cold water as well at the weekend. He thought it was particularly vital in the race on Sunday.
Yeah, I have to say, I mean, last year it was terrible with the feed zones, you know, in the worlds. Like, it was really difficult to get bottles in these feed zones. And actually, we did an illegal feed outside of the feed zone last year because we knew it was going to be impossible to get these bottles, you know, because there's so many teams. And, you know, the other thing is there's a lot of these smaller nations that they don't exactly have, like, perhaps the most experienced staff, so they don't always know how to, like...
Are you suggesting that Valerio Alessandri of Sao Tome and Principe isn't an expert masseur?
I mean, he might be. But you know, sometimes that can cause a little extra chaos in the feed zones. But I have to say, this year, it was actually, like, quite easy. It was a lot easier than it was last year to get bottles. And I don't know if that was the placement of the feed zones, or because every single feed zone this year has been just an absolute mess, and now we're just used to it, you know, because they changed the rule this year. So it might have been a little bit of both, but I have to say, actually, we were able to, like, every single time get bottles, and you didn't lose, like, a ton of positions. So, but yeah, you weren't going back to the car too much. Two times I went back to the car on the circuit to get things for, like, Quinn, but... In the end, it was okay, but it would take probably at least a half a lap to get back to the front, you know? So you have to be really careful when you go back to the car in a situation like that. But I would say most people were able to get bottles every time through the feed zones without a whole lot of issue.
Yeah. I think we're going to talk about another aspect of this World Championships in a second. And just to sort of lead us into that, Larry, we were going to say one or two things about the crowds. Again, at the weekend, we talked about this moment that we watched the peloton go through, well, go off the main lap and onto the Mount Kigali lap, and there was a noticeable difference in the crowd sizes. The crowd sizes, well, they certainly bore comparison with what we had seen. We've all seen, I think, you know, YouTube videos of the Tour of Rwanda and the Mud of Kigali, and that was sort of what we expected from the whole World Championships. We didn't necessarily get it, but we did get it on parts of the course. And I said to Lionel on Sunday, I saw two Swiss riders. Almost, you could almost see them kind of turning to each other and kind of laughing, smiling, sort of pinching themselves, because it was clear that they were taken aback by it. I spoke to an African rider yesterday who wasn't at the World Championships at the weekend. And he said he thought it was a shame, and he was under the impression that there was some sort of segregation that had happened, that the main circuit wasn't accessible to sort of common Rwandans, or not everyone was able to get onto the circuit as a spectator. I'm not sure whether that's the case or not. But what was your impression from a rider's point of view?
Yeah, we kind of wondered that. Like, I mean, we also didn't know if maybe just people there, you know, if you're not used to watching a bike race, maybe you don't exactly know. You just think, well, if the riders pass here, like, you know, cool, we'll watch here. You know, like maybe if it's close to their homes. And because actually, so anyway, I guess, you know, the circuit was cool. There were a lot of people. It was nice. But that was the most impressive thing, was when we were heading to this Mount Kigali. And even, I mean, the sad thing was, like, on the descent before, it was like, on the descent, there were so many people, and we were like, oh my gosh, this is insane.
Is it any coincidence that this was the point in the race when you came to the front, Larry? Was it all, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. It was just all the motivation I got. But yeah, then we came down, and that was exactly where you saw the two Swiss guys. I mean, it was like 20 people deep. Like, I've never seen so many people at a bike race in my life, and it was insane. And really, like, you did get like goosebumps. It was like you got the chills, like, going through this, and it was so cool. And everyone was looking at each other like, holy shit, you know, like, this is crazy. So it was really, really nice. But I don't know if it was also, you know, every time when we went training and we went through this part, this was without a doubt where the most people were in Kigali, you know. So I mean, this was like the busiest intersection. There were so many people every time we passed there in training the week before the race. So I don't know if that was just maybe the most populated area, and that all those people were like, oh, it comes by where we live, we'll just go here, you know? That I'm not sure. But so, yeah, I mean, it was just not the best location to watch a bike race, because we came down off of a hill into this intersection and we were flying, and that was where the most people were. And then, you know, there were a lot on this Mount Kigali, but really this intersection before was just like incredible. I mean, really, It was absurd how many people were there, but it was a really, really nice experience, you know. That was really cool. But it was a shame that they didn't get to be on like the main part of the course. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, it didn't appear that, you know, there was security on all parts of the course, but it wasn't like it was closed off if you were walking down the sidewalk. So I don't know if it was just more ease of access, or people who are unfamiliar with watching bike races and they just knew that the course went by there, and so they were there, you know.
Yeah, I certainly think that the crowds and just the sense of occasion really indicates that this could be a moment for cycling in Africa. This week I spoke to Michael de Lagrange, who is one of the founders of Team Armani, and the sports director of the team, Daniel, is Scarborough Girmay, former World Tour pro, of course, rode the Tour de France for Lamprey, I think it was, also rode for Jayco.
Yeah, rode three tours, I think.
Yeah, and, well, Mikel, or Michael, he doesn't mind which pronunciation of his first name we use, along with Sule Kangangi, founded Team Armani, and their aim is to take an African team to the Tour de France. Now, I know Dimension Data has already kind of been the African team at the Tour de France, but the distinction here is a team that is based and sourcing its talent from Africa, predominantly East Africa. They had riders in the World Championships from Ethiopia, Rwanda, Kenya, Uganda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, competing across the categories, including in the elite road race. And, well, let's hear a little bit about what Michael made of being in Rwanda last week for the World Championships. Well, Michael, thank you for joining me. First of all, can you tell me a little bit about yourself and also the team that you're involved with?
Yeah, hi, my name is Michael. I'm the head cheerleader of Team Imani. It's what I call myself. But I co-founded this project with Sule Kangange about 5 years ago. And it's a professional cycling team based out of East Africa.
And you were in Kigali for the World Championships. Were you there for the whole week? What did you make of it? What was your overall impression of the Road World Championships taking place in Rwanda?
Well, I think we had our team there, and I think, obviously it was a historical event. I think it was exactly the kind of professional event that we knew that the Rwandan Federation and the Rwandan authorities could put on. And I think it also demonstrated, of course, that cycling is bigger than Europe, right? And it's got an international appeal. And the more that we enable the sport to, step out of its traditional confines, the more people will be able to participate.
So just on that and your team, what was the team's kind of involvement in the World Championships? You had athletes taking part?
Yeah, we have athletes in five different countries. So we had representation through all the federations, and also people who are working with our project are also working together with the Rwandan Federation to basically share knowledge and support wherever we can.
Which nations were they representing?
So we have Rwanda, Uganda, Kenya, Ethiopia, Democratic Republic of Congo at the moment.
And so just tell me a bit about how the team itself actually operates, where it competes, what kind of level it's at. I know you've got an ex-World Tour rider as part of the sports direction team. Just tell me a little bit about how it's all structured and what a sort of typical season looks like.
Yeah, so we kicked off in the beginning because my partner, Sule Kangange, was a professional cyclist, and he was basically explaining that cyclists from East Africa could get only so far, and then they'd hit a glass ceiling. So we kind of sought to explore the things that had been done in the past, Dimension Data and various other projects and initiatives, and see where they kind of went off the rails and see if we could address some of those shortcomings. And really, basically, Lionel, it boils down to access to racing opportunities. If your audience takes away nothing, let it be that. So the difference between a kid from Kigali and a kid from Bruges is that the kid from Bruges can fall out of bed and into a race. And then when he fails, he can come home, have his mom's pea soup, and then fail again the next weekend. That does not happen anywhere on the continent, right? A lot of the athletes have the Tour of Rwanda to look forward to that takes place in February and may not race again until their national championships, which take place in July.
Daniel, I think we'll put the whole of that conversation with Michael de Lagrange out on an episode of Kilometre Zero in the coming days, maybe early next week, because it was a really interesting conversation. I learned a lot about the work that the team is trying to do to create opportunities for riders. As he said there, the difference is that the riders from that part of Africa don't have the opportunities to fail that riders from Western Europe or even the United States have. He made that point about a rider from Bruges can kind of get up, go and race, fail, and then try again the next day or the next week. And it's about exposing the riders to more racing and then more racing of a higher level. And so they have very ambitious aims to start competing more broadly across Europe and the rest of the world, and their sights are set on the Tour de France. So we'll play that whole conversation probably next week. The other interesting aspect is that Michael de Lagrange, his day job is an international criminal lawyer, which is a niche sort of part of human rights law. So he works in predominantly East Africa. He's doing some work in Sudan at the moment. And so the subject of Rwanda hosting the World Championships and the sports washing aspect of it also came up in our conversation. And he had some interesting observations on that. So listen out for that early next week.
Oh, no, you mentioned their ambitions, Team Imani's ambitions to go to the Tour de France. with a men's team, but also a women's team. And I think they feel a little bit more confident that the women with the women's team, it might happen earlier with the men than with the men's team.
Absolutely right. Yeah. Michael says in the conversation that they've actually flipped some of the emphasis in the team, some of the funding to back the women team and try and get to the Tour de France femme first. And you know, that is an equally ambitious, but perhaps slightly achievable target, I would suggest.
Well, Charles, I think that pretty much concludes our summary of the World Championships. Of course, we've got the European Championships this week, and maybe a chance for Remco to... Well, Remco's already made amends in the time trial, not that he needed to, because, of course, he was the World Time Trial. He became, again, the World Time Trial champion last week. He became the European champion yesterday, comprehensive win over Filippo Ganna and the Danish rider whose name Lionel's going to tell
Nicholas
me.
Nicholas
Larsen. Have you ever come across him before, Larry?
No, but I mean, I just noticed him in Tour Denmark and I saw that this Unibet Tita Meraki's team signed him, which seems like, yeah, a good signing. And I guess he had been on Uno X before. And I guess he was also a very good track rider. I think he did Team Pursuit on the track. So, yeah, looks like they made a really good signing and, strong rider.
So Remco already has added the European time trial crown to the World Time Trial crown. That was yesterday. Now, at the weekend, we've got the road race with Pogacar back in action. I don't know what he's going to do with that European Champions jersey. Should he win it, stuff it under the rainbow jersey? Possibly. Jonas Vingegaard is also riding. I think it's going to be his last appearance of the season. Remco, as I said, is also riding. And the course, chaps, Larry, you're probably familiar with parts of this course because it's based on the course of the Fourne-Ardèche Drôme Classic, which happens every year, most recently won by Romain Grégoire. Now, I thought it was an exact facsimile. It's not, but...
They use the same climbs.
They use the two same climbs.
Just maybe in different orders and stuff.
Yeah, so the first probably three quarters of the race really is characterized by the three ascents of the Saint-Romain-de-l'Air climb, which is 7 kilometers at 7.2%, so quite a significant climb, a long climb. And then the last sort of quarter of the race sees the peloton go over the Val d'Enfer climb, which is 1.5 kilometers at about 10%, four times. And then it's a pretty flat finish. 3,400 meters of altitude. Although after the weekend, Larry, I was going to ask you about this actually. I don't think I'll ever trust the altitude meters I see given on various sources by various sources again, because there was a vast spectrum on Strava the next day of the vertical meters.
Are you sure that wasn't because some people did more than others?
Well, I think even the riders that finished the race, they diverged wildly.
Yeah.
So anyway, it looks like a course where, I mean, I'm kind of curious about Jonas Vingegaard deciding to ride because, he should go relatively well on this course, but it certainly looks very much tailor-made for Pogacar again.
Yeah, it's going to be a crazy hard race, so it'll be good to watch, that's for sure.
And Larry, just before we do go, last time we had you on, we didn't mention the fact, and in fact it hadn't been confirmed, that you had extended or were going to extend your stay with Tudor Pro Cycling, thereby increasing my chances of a free watch.
Yeah, potentially.
even further. I don't want one, Larry. I don't need one. I don't need that in my life.
Okay, well, good. so I'm pretty excited. It'll be a nice, two more years with the team. I've really enjoyed this season, and yeah, I've been feeling good, and it's been a nice year for me. So. I feel like I really got a nice role here, and yeah, it's worked out well. So really looking forward to doing another 2 years in the Peloton, and then, yeah, we'll see. I think I'll probably be ready to call it a day at the end of the 2 years.
No,
but
don't say
never
that.
Say never.
Very consistent, Larry. Very consistent. You've been this year, haven't you? I don't think you've DNF'd at all, have you? You've got through every race on your program.
Yeah, no, just the Worlds, unfortunately, you know.
And another thing I noticed, I think you've been in three races this year, and two of them have gone to the finish, which is a good record.
Yeah, I don't remember what the third one was, but I do remember in the Giro and Burgos. So the other one I don't remember, but yeah.
Well, just before we go, Daniel, I was just going to drag us back to the European Championships. I mean, you know, sport isn't political, but Larry, of course, not eligible to race on account of not being European. Remco, you mentioned his...
You're all right. You've got an Irish passport like me. I was going to ask you whether you were still European. Anyway,
well, hang on. I mean, great...
I know. You don't need to explain.
Oh dear, your grasp on European geopolitics is
actually
shaky.
Do you know what on this, I was in the mix zone at the Vuelta a España. An Italian colleague asked Ben O'Connor whether he was going to do the European Championships, and Ben O'Connor was not
I would have loved to see the response.
Amused. He was not amused.
Well, you mentioned what would Pogacar do if he wins the European jersey as well, which is white with the blue band and the gold stars. Well, Remco Evenepoel, he's got quite a collection of jerseys because he is the current reigning Belgian, European, World and Olympic time trial champion, isn't he? The other aspect that's interesting is that Jonas Vingegaard is going to ride his first race since winning the Vuelta, of course. You know, head-to-head with Pogacar is a compelling storyline, but I think also the strength of the Danish team with Mathias Skelmoser and Mads Pedersen. But Vingegaard and one-day races are like oil and water, aren't they? They don't really mix. He hasn't done a single one-day race this year. Last year, he did one, the Clásica San Sebastián, and didn't finish. 2023, didn't do any. 2022, he finished Lombardia in 16th place. He was a non-finisher at Flèche Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège. He did finish the Grand Prix d'Henan, which he rode because those sections of cobbles were going to be in the Tour de France course. But interestingly, his last and I think only one day race win as a pro, the Drôme Classic, he won in spring 2022 on similar terrain. Is that the one that's exactly the same parts of the course, or is it the Four Nardèches? Because they're back to back, aren't they, those two one-day races? Anyway,
I think Drôme is the one that's the same.
So
final.
Literally just down the road from where the race starts anyway, so it'll be very familiar territory for him. So maybe that is an indicator of what will happen on Sunday. We'll wait and see.
So I chucked earlier when I mentioned the race, I chucked Drôme in the same name, Four Nardèches and Drôme, I said, which is of course wrong. They're two regions. It's the Four Nardèches and the Four Drôme the next day. They're sort of they're neighbours, those regions, or they're close by, but not the same race. Anyway, chaps, we shall enjoy that as much as we've enjoyed your company today, Larry, and hopefully be welcoming you again in the coming weeks. But enjoy the end of the season, Larry.
Thanks, guys.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.